Welcome back to the Clean Sailors Podcast. Let's talk about sea, marine, sailing, and keeping it clean. I'm your host, Holly, founder of Clean Sailors, and a sailor myself with a passion for the health of our mighty oceans. Through conversations with experts, innovators, and activists, all working towards improving the health of our seas, we're showcasing the people and projects changing the way things are done. Now we know since the 1950s, GRP and FRP hulls, glass and fibre reinforced plastics, became the go-to for boat building. These materials were revolutionary, not just for maintenance, cost and performance, but also increasing the accessibility of boats to a much wider audience. Fast forward several decades, however, and these materials, meaning thousands and thousands of boats, are at end of life with no formal recycling opportunities anywhere in the world. So, what currently happens to boats when they die? And what impact are they having on the environment? I'm joined by Dr. Karina Chokan, Principal Lecturer in Ecotoxicology, Marine Biology at the University of Brighton. Thank you for joining me, Karina, to help dissect this topic.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited by this because, as we mentioned earlier, we often believe that sailing is quite a low impact sport, pleasure, pastime, because we use the power of the wind. But obviously, we are increasingly aware of the materials, substances that we use on our boats to preserve our boats that are obviously having a significantly detrimental impact on our environment. You've obviously been exploring fiberglass and sort of glass reinforced fiber for a while from an environmental perspective. How did you first get into this specific subject and what have you been finding?
This is a really nice question because I really like to talk about the start of this research, the starting point of this research. And I often say that, you know, like a lot of other discoveries, if you want, everything happened by accident. Years ago, probably about 6-7 years ago, I was working in Chichester Harbour in collaboration with Chichester Harbour Conservancy, because the conservancy and the community in the harbour were very worried about the plastic pollution. At that time, they had a lot of measures in place to reduce the macroplastic, you know, all the recycling bins set up around the harbour, around the pathways, but they wanted to know a little bit more about the microplastic. So a team from Brighton University spent, myself included, a whole summer in Chichester Harbour collecting water, collecting sediment, and also collecting oysters and mussels for analysis in the laboratory and to identify microplastics, basically. Well, we were really, really amazed by the particles that we discovered in oysters and in mussels. There were those tiny, tiny shards, very, very dense, very brittle, very glass-looking like under the microscope, and we had no idea where they were potentially coming from. I'm not a boater. I never had a boat. I never heard of GRP before at that moment in my life. And so we started all this detective work, you know, to understand what is it? Is it is something that the oysters will produce, you know, pretty much like the pearls, but then it was present in mussels as well. And so slowly, and there was nothing, no research that was published at that time, you know, for us to have a reference for that material. So we had to do a little bit more chemistry analysis and then spectrometry as well. And we discovered that it's glass. It is E-type glass, huge quantity accumulated in both type of organism. And then we discovered that actually we collected those organisms from in front of some very active boatyards in December, January. So when the boatyards were at maximum activity. And so slowly we realized that yes, this is a GRP product. So this is the fiberglass that is coming from the GRP, is coming from all the activities that are happening in the boatyard at that particular time. And then everything started from there. That was the moment when we realized, wow, this is yet another contaminant in the environment that we have no idea about. It's still a very, very little research about the presence of this contaminant in the environment, I have to say. This is something that we definitely need to address.
So just to recap, you were finding not just sort of everyday microplastics in the water and in the flesh of these organisms, effectively oysters and mussels, you were actually finding like hair-like shards of glass within them. So that was obviously could only be from GRP sort of FRP hulls.
Yeah, it was very interesting because as I said, we were in a way we were lucky because we collected the organisms from in front of a boatyard. And so what we found in the oysters and mussels were very tiny fragments, identical in width. So they were all tubular, transparent, and almost identical in size. So they were like 100 microns, 50 to 100 microns. So this is a tenth of your hair diameter. And that took us, well, later on, talking to boaters, to workers in the boatyards and so on, we realized that those specific particles that were ingested by our organism must have come from a sort of procedure, maybe sanding, something that created those almost identical particles that have been available in the environment. So it was easy, in a way, to put two and two together. In front of the boatyard, the shards were almost identical. The oysters were there at that moment in time. The boatyard was very active because it was December, January, when the boats are going through the maintenance. So everything aligned perfectly. Obviously, later on, we had pieces of GRP, old, new, and so on, and we analyzed those again chemically and spectrophotometer, and we proved that the same fingerprint, chemical fingerprint and spectrometric fingerprint is in those pieces as to the ones that we found in the organism, just to prove, you know, the provenience, obviously. And as I said, I'm not a boater. I didn't know anything about boats at that time. All I was interested in was the impact on my organism, on oysters and mussels. And so I started with, you know, 100 microns shards, and then a little bit like, you know, you uncover piece by piece of a big jigsaw. I've ended up on looking at the boats, abandoned boats and end-of-life boats, and I realized that, yes, the problem is really big.
I hear you. I guess that in some ways it would follow that any scraping or grinding or repair of hulls without obviously adequate capture of all the material that's coming off would potentially, whether airborne or otherwise, drift into adjacent water, which you found within oysters.
Yeah.
Not okay, I appreciate, because it is a contaminant and it is toxic and it is a pollutant. But it would follow that if the immediacy of a boatyard, oysters in the water almost adjacent to it, that there may be some markers in there. But this is a much bigger problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I know that you've just alluded to that kind of, you know, you're almost scratching at the surface of something.
Yeah.
And this is really a big issue because of the number of boats that, A, we have on our planet, and secondarily, the number that are now almost reaching end of life. And I think I'd love to sort of dive into this further, because we're talking hundreds of thousands coming up end of life every year now. We're talking about 35, 40 million plus registered leisure boats on the planet, and that's registered, with hundreds of thousands of those coming up for end of life every year. So not just my little one boat yard and the oysters outside of it, but what does this actually mean in terms of size and scale for our marine environment?
It can be potentially devastating. Myself and my colleagues were looking at the natural degradation of the material, you know, only boats sitting on the water, or even worse, in some sort of intertidal area where they will be exposed to, you know, natural degradation from the salt water, different temperatures, solar impact as well. But also in intertidal, you'd have boats that sit on the sediment. They are a little bit scraped against the sediment. So, and this is just the natural degradation. And it's astonishing how much plastic, paint, fiberglass, on top of all the additional chemicals, can be leaked from just the weathering of the boat. And to add to this, we have now a really powerful scientific paper that was published by a group from Germany to show that 80% of microplastics that are present in the North Sea are probably associated with the boating industry. So forget the Sainsbury bag or the whatever still water bottle. It's the degradation, the natural degradation of the boat hull and the anti-fouling paint, the normal paint, the resin from the GRP, and then going into the fiberglass that actually leaks into the water and contributes to this microplastic pollution. What scares me the most is the fact that we have this powder, the GRP powder, that is a combination of resin and fiberglass. Two very, very different components in terms of their chemical characteristic, but also their behavior in the water. The powder looks pretty much like flour or baking soda or whatever. It's just powder. But when you sprinkle that powder in the water, you realize that you have a sequence, a component of that powder that is going to stay on top of the water, and that is the resin. And then you're going to have the other component that is going to drop down on the sediment, and that is the fiberglass. So suddenly you have two components that are going to have a maximum impact on both areas of an estuary, of a marina, of a lake, of a whatever. You have the plastic that is going to float on top, accessible for whatever aquatic organism are at that level, accessible even for birds or for insects that are coming to feed on top of the water. And then you'll have the glass that is going to drop down on the sediment, and that's going to be available for any bottom dwellers or any bivalves, any benthic organism. So it's like maximum impact, minimum effort with maximum impact, and that is quite scary. And that also, thinking about the behavior of those two components later on, you can think of the plastic being drifted away, you know, by waves and by tides and so on, by currents. But then you have the fiberglass that is probably going to sink in the sediment. But also, and this is something that we recently found, fiberglass that is able to almost like impale soft material. We found pieces of algae, for example, a small snail, pieces of other organic material that look like pin cushions, because they had about, you know, tens and tens of fiberglass impaled into. And I suspect it's a combination of currents and the contact between that soft organism or piece of organic material with those very, very sharp shards. And that's going to have this effect. And then you have this piece of organic material. We have a picture of a very tiny snail, bless him, that looks like a pincushion. You have those organics just circulating in the water, and they are food for something. They are food for a fish. They are food for a different organism, bigger organism. And that's how you have the transfer in the trophic chain, and also the transport from the area of contamination to various other areas.
I guess that's the point. There's no such thing as a way. So if it's been drifting from one area, it's going to end up somewhere else. It's fascinating. I mean, no one can see me except for you. But I'm wincing. I've been wincing since really we started this conversation, because, you know, arguably it is a very uncomfortable one. It's uncomfortable, obviously, as a sailor and as a boat owner, but also almost as a human who relies on the ocean as much as anybody else does. But I think what I hadn't appreciated was that the whole body of water, the water column effectively, was polluted by this substance, in that, as you mentioned, the resin sort of powder sits up top, and then you've got slightly denser particulate matter settling down towards sort of the seabed. Largely, that may not be too much of an issue unless you're in shallows or you've got bottom dredging going on and the whole thing's just getting churned. Yeah. And I know the Oldenburg study, it was the University of Oldenburg, I think it was, who produced that research around the North Sea, the German Bight, because we looked at that with regards to antifouling in particular. And you're right, it was 80% of microplastics in the water up there were attributed to shipping and boating.
Yeah.
And at the time, we were kind of still understanding that that was mostly to do with antifoul. But what your research has been able to show is that boats are always shedding. This isn't
Yeah.
just an end of life issue whereby I dump my boat on a beach somewhere because I can't afford or nor do I want to take care of it, but it's bashing away, it starts to break down, all of the pieces
Yeah.
obviously end up in the environment. We're talking about any boat on the water is shedding microfibers and also glass fibers, right?
Yes, yeah, it's the normal weathering of the material. And as I said, it's a combination of solar radiation, various temperatures, and mechanical impact of waves and, I don't know, jetty, you know, you're next to a jetty or, yes, it's the normal weathering, basically, yes.
So we're talking, going back to that really high figure, which I think the IMO has kind of reported on calculating roughly how many boats we've got on our planet registered. We know it's at least about 40 million, right? And they're the registered ones. So each of those boats, our boats, shedding, and then each of our boats aging ultimately to a point where they become end of life vessels and ultimately at the moment have no formal recycling opportunities.
Basically, that's kind of it. Indeed, I can see that you're very disturbed. I totally appreciate, but we have to remember that this has been a design flaw from the very beginning. The manufacturers should have a stewardship of the material. You know, when you create something, you have to think about what's going to happen to that thing at the very end of life. You know, how about what's going to happen? Yes, in 20, 30, 40 years, what do we do with it? And especially because we're talking about huge, huge products. It's not just a needle or, you know, it's a boat. What's going to happen with that boat at the very end of life? So this I find absolutely amazing that the industry is booming and the production is growing every year with the same material or very little modification. Yes, the resins can be quite different now, but ultimately it's still an non-recyclable material that is used to build tens of meters of boats in the end. I'm amazed because I'm thinking, right, if the same thing would happen with the cars, for example, when the car gets old and there's nothing to do with it, if we would abandon the cars on the street or in parks or wherever, that's it, it's old, nothing to do with it, what would have happened? But with the boats, nobody says anything. They are abandoned in creeks and in estuaries and in more in your face or less in your face places. And it's still like, yeah, business as usual. I have a very dear friend in Canada who runs a charity. It's called Dead Boat Societies. And he gets a grant from the Canadian government. He's around Vancouver. He has to apply for a grant from the Canadian government to retrieve abandoned boats. For this, he has to first do a survey of the area and roughly write a report to say how many boats, where they are. But most importantly, he has to prove that the boats are leaking oil or they are obstructing navigational pathways. Because otherwise he doesn't get any money. The government doesn't care about any other boats that are sunk or half broken or, you know, just abandoned on the beach or whatever, if they're not leaking oil or they're not obstructing any pathway. And he can see, you know, because he's local and he can see the boats degrading under his eyes, yet another piece here and another piece here and the fibers being exposed and, I don't know, birds coming and picking up various bits because obviously you'll have some growth on those wrecks. But without this scientific proof, he can't do anything because that's what the government is throwing back. We know for sure that the oil leakage is going to contaminate the environment and we know that oil can be carcinogenic and la, la, la. If there is any obstruction, obviously there is a very great danger for any other passing boat and so on. But other than that, that's it. I think this is where I'm coming from. I can offer, and I am trying to offer, this very basic impact, which is not basic, it's actually very complicated and it's very painful. And that's why from the very beginning, I started to use the term of asbestos-like when I'm talking about the fiberglass, because at least that's going to ring some very loud bells. And it's not, I mean, I'm not just throwing words over there, you know, it's actually, my scientific opinion is that, yes, they are asbestos-like particles. You have the fiberglass that can't be degraded in any other chemical component. It's a glass and it will always be a glass. It won't be dissolved or anything in the natural environment. It has a very, very small diameter, about 20 microns, which is extremely small. And so once it enters a tissue, a soft organic tissue, it's like a splinter. Okay, you can extract the splinter from your fingers, but if it gets into your lungs, and that's why asbestos was considered and is still considered so dangerous, because once inside the organism, you can't excrete it. It's not coming out. It's going to be embedded in trachea, in lungs, in other organs, and then the organism obviously is going to react, you're going to have an inflammation, and that's going to get more and more serious. And it's the same mechanism in any other organism. Once it's in, it's going to stay in, it's not going to come out. And that's quite tragic.
It is. And you said I was looking disturbed, and honestly, I am. I think it almost sheds just such a different light on it. And I think the two things are, I appreciate your comment around when we've produced things that we ought to be thinking about, what does this look like in 10, 20, 30, 40 years? And I appreciate in the 1950s, the advent of GRP, FRP, certainly at scale, I'm not sure necessarily we had the sort of technology, the mindset. Obviously, the scale was incredibly different. I mean, now we're talking 40 million plus boats, because pretty much, you know, I'd say like 80% of those produced over the last years are still around today, right? It's just compounding, it's continuing. So in some ways, I'm slightly forgiving of us not having that mindset, because I don't think anyone would have foreseen this becoming so prevalent, there being so many, such a large portion of the world's demographic having the accessibility and the income even to partake in leisure boating in particular. And I appreciate the science, you know, from the 1950s today, as you will know more than anybody, has sort of come on exceptional leaps and bounds. So we now know what we know, as damaging as it is. And just going back to your point around the sort of content of these substances, once they get into organisms, we have obviously seen there's a lot of research out now, as you well know, that these kind of elements and compounds within any kind of organic matter can change, you know, feeding activity, impact hormone levels and reproductive systems, and reduce the population sizes. And as you said, there's a food chain going on here too. So any insect that's feeding on the water, picking up any of this resin dust, is then being eaten by birds, is then being eaten by something else. And it kind of is ongoing. And it's not insignificant what you mentioned about these particles being sort of asbestos-like, because we know that microplastics obviously have a massive impact on us anyway, but these fiberglass particles are slightly more serious, to the extent that, as you said, they're shards and they get stuck. So, you know, there's cancer related, there's chronic lung diseases, there's heart and respiratory diseases as a result of it. Honestly, none of it sounds particularly positive, aside from the fact that we now know this, now we understand it, and we've got the research and brilliant brains such as yourself showing us, because I think that's another major cause of inaction has been, I don't think we've yet mass understood or mass appreciated the impact of using these kind of materials on our marine environment. And certainly within the, say, marine and the boat building industry, your research in the long history and trajectory of that is relatively new.
That's absolutely true. And when you think about the impact of those particles, and especially fiberglass, the potential impact that they can have on the organism, you have to remember that we kind of know about how dangerous they are on human health, for example, on human body, because we have all those rules and regulations for the boat workers and also in the factories, you know, fiberglass factories. So we know very well masks, all the PPE protection and how strict they should be and so on. So we're very aware of that. Well, exactly the same thing happens in the marine environment. We have those sharks that are present over there. They can impale the organism, so they can have all those fiberglass or you know, like tiny javelins basically embedded in their outside skin or carapace or whatever they have. But it's also the problem of, you know, ingesting those and then not being able to get rid of them. We had a lot of experimentation with microplastics, and I think one good outcome of a lot of laboratory studies was that most of the organisms were able to ingest the microplastics and then excrete almost 60, 70, 80% of them. You know, I had student projects that came up with this percentage, you know, mussels exposed for 24 hours and then depurated for another 24 hours, and they managed to get rid of the plastic. A lot of it, not everything, but a lot of it. It's not the same with the fiberglass. We had mussels that we collected from Chichester Harbour. We kept in the lab for about 10 days. And then when we dissected the mussels, the fiberglass was still there. And it's logical. Yes, once they enter, they're not coming out. I said a little bit earlier that we're yet to establish the true size of the contamination. And I'm really worried that thinking about how the fiberglass can interact with the soft organism, and I'm thinking about worms here, you know, sea worms or just earthworms, any soft organism, because until now, yes, I was talking about mussels and oysters, but any soft organism that is present in the sediment. And here I'm thinking again about Chichester Harbour, where I started all this research, and the fact that Natural England, for example, downgraded the habitats in Chichester Harbour about 2-3 years ago to unfavorable. The fact that they lose salt marshes at a rate of 2 acres a year, just because the sediment has become too anoxic. It's just that black, foul-smelling sediment that is so easily washed away by the tides and by the waves. And that's how they lose land, basically, over there. And I'm thinking that the nail in the coffin could be this fact that this fiberglass accumulated in the sediment, having such a drastic impact on soft organisms like the worms that are so important to create spaces in the sediment, to allow the nutrients, to allow the oxygen to penetrate into the sediment, and then to allow also the seagrass, the weeds, the seaweeds, and the salt marsh to develop. That can be quite a dramatic picture. And I'm not saying this just hypothetically. We had about 2 years ago, we ran an international project, and Chichester Harbour Conservancy was one of the partners. And we commissioned a study with the Natural History Museum, a study to survey the biodiversity in the sediment in several locations in Chichester Harbour. So we had a specialist from the Natural History Museum collecting samples of the sediment, and we were looking especially at bivalves, at mollusks. He came back, you know, completely, completely amazed to say that there is nothing. There is no life in the samples that we provided, and it's all that black anoxic sediment with some very old shells or broken shells that show that, yes, there was life at some point, but there isn't anymore. That's how I started to picture this idea that we have a chemical contamination, you know, sewage and all other substances that are present in the water in Chichester Harbour. But we definitely have to look at this particulate contamination, and especially the fiberglass, and see how that might have had a massive role in wiping out a lot of organisms from the sediment.
Wow, Hard to know what to say at times. I think the it really isn't a pretty picture, and it's actually quite fascinating. Obviously, I grew up sailing in Chichester waters and around the Solent, so I know it very well, and obviously know that this is the absolute hotbed of boating activity, certainly in the UK, if not certainly probably the second largest in Europe. So as a proxy for the opportunities and damage caused by the boating and the shipping industry, this is probably as good as it gets as a sort of test bed as an environment. So what you're saying, obviously, is the impact of this sort of the byproducts of boating and obviously abandoned boats also are almost sucking the life out of incredibly important ecosystems. So you mentioned sort of the salt marshes and say mud flat. I know exactly the type of mud and sediment you're talking about because I've been stuck in it once, my knees, and it is horrific stuff, devoid of everything. It smells like something, I mean, you wouldn't wish it on anybody. It is very anoxic, as you mentioned. So, like you said, the importance of having sort of those soft species like worms to aerate it, the same as you would having, worms great in your garden to keep the oxygen moving through the soil, keeping it fertile and growing. Without that, obviously, you then can't, there is no ecosystem there really, because nothing else can grow without having that oxygen provided. So it is an incredibly stark description, Karina, about the impact that this is sort of having locally. I'm sitting in the Solent having this conversation with you right now. But appreciating then, so we know that this is an issue. We know that it's an issue for every boat that's in existence today, because all of them are constantly shedding. And we also know that hundreds of thousands a year are becoming disused effectively. Traditionally, they are still dumped for landowners to deal with, or they're scuttled. So they're, someone sticks a drill through the hull and lets them sink somewhere. And I read something really interesting in some of your research around even the impacts of natural disasters. So the hurricane season, I think at least 30,000 to 60,000 boats each year, or every time there's this major hurricane, normally on the other side of the Atlantic in the Caribbean, results in obviously scuttling tens of thousands of boats too. So we're constantly using the ocean and the sea as literally the dumping ground. These old boats, a bit out of sight, out of mind, bury the thing, put it in the water, we forget about it, believing that somehow that dilution of the pollution is still the solution, which I hoped had died out in the 70s as a mentality, but clearly not. So we know that this is an issue, right? We also know that there are no formal recycling facilities anywhere in the world really to deal with this issue. We also know that legislation, international legislation, doesn't yet appear to be covering topics such as end of life. So I know they talk a lot around obviously discharging grey water and black water. You've got to be certain sort of distances offshore. You can't discharge plastic or litter into the sea. We all know that. But obviously, this topic isn't yet covered by any formal legislation in terms of a pollutant. So, what, from your perspective, do you see as being the clear steps forward for the industry and the legislature around dealing with this opportunity? I appreciate that's a massive question, but where do you feel is the most obvious place to start?
Well, I think first of all, we have to acknowledge that GRP is a hazardous material. And I had a discussion with some specialists in the environmental agency, and we all agree that that's the first step, And they actually gave me a really nice example, and they said that, the catalytic convector in cars, that one contains heavy metals and some asbestos and so on. So that is considered hazardous. And that's one of the reasons why you can't abandon your car on the road. And the government had put into place this massive, well, I suspect it happens in a lot of countries, this scheme where you can take your car to the recycling and you get £200 off. But the main reason is that parts of the car are considered hazardous. And so you would expose yourself and the others to a sort of contamination. Well, this is something that has to be acknowledged for the GRP as well. It is hazardous. And years ago, I was talking to a colleague in the United States who, again, he got a sort of a grant from the government to get abandoned boats, smash them to pieces, mix them with cement, and use them to make pavements or roads because nobody wanted to go into buildings. Again, it was an uncharted territory, so they didn't want to put that cement into buildings that they thought, yeah, roads and pavements are okay. But then, because of my research, they actually stopped that scheme, because by smashing that GRP, they created so much dust and so much contamination that would go freely into the water that it was saving something to actually destroy something else. So they stopped that. So is that idea of having the GRP declared hazardous, and then none of the boats can go to the landfill anymore? Because that's yet another problem, you know, that we all say that by, I don't know, 2050, is it? The last governmental pledge that we're going to reduce our input to landfill to 60% or something. If you take three boats over there and you go over the limit and declare the material hazardous, and then that's going to fuel the research into recycling, fuel the research into what to do with the material. So we can't put it to landfill, so we have to do something about it. And that's going to start a bigger conversation.
Do you think having the legislation lead on this topic in particular is going to provide the most profound paradigm shift effectively in the way that we manage this material?
Yes, definitely. I make a comparison here with cars and with petrol as well. You know, it was only until we realized that the air quality is absolutely appalling, that the oil reserves are going down as well, that the entire revolution into, you know, electric cars and so on started. Until then, there were just discussions. I think it's the same here. We have to realize that we have a huge contamination of the coastal environment especially, and there is absolutely nothing we can do about the abandoned boats other than smash them and take them to their landfill. But that landfill is limited, and especially for island countries like ours, you know, that's going to push the government into, yes, doing something. This is a hazardous material. It can't be approved to go to landfill together with all the other rubbish. And so something needs to be done.
I guess also that does help with the formalization through the more formal routes such as landfill. But if I wanted to scuttle my boat when it's too old and unhappy to use anymore, I still could without very little repercussion, unless anyone knew that it was my boat. And that's something which, certainly in the UK, I understand within the boating community specifically, there is a bit of reluctance to move towards boat registration. Because the big difference between the car industry and owning a car, as you rightly mentioned, versus boats, whilst they're very, very similar, as an analogy, it's perfect. The difference is you know who a car belongs to. There's a centralized register because they are, as you said, made up of a variety of materials, some of which are incredibly hazardous. So we know if someone dumps a car, who effectively it belongs to. When you have the same with a boat, unless you're obviously a customer registered with a marina or a harbor authority, or you're on the, you know, the ship's register being over a certain size, then we don't have a very good control of who owns what and where it is. I know in Europe, we're looking at progressing that kind of route and centralizing that information, because arguably that's actually an incredibly important way in starting to ensure that our profession, recreation, passion, pleasure, pastime becomes much more ocean-minded and arguably a lot fairer. But if we partake in anything, that we should be contributing to minimizing the environmental impact of it. And that process ought to arguably be quite transparent.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. They should go hand in hand, you know. As you said, knowing exactly who owns the boat will actually ensure that that boat is not going to be abandoned, because it is a hazardous material. And so you knowingly, by leaving your boat, I don't know, wherever, you're actually, you know, impacting the environment, but also human health, anybody who's enjoying that area. So, yes, they should go hand in hand, but I know that this is a very sensitive topic, you know, the registration and, yes, the ownership, the whole ownership. I don't know what to say about this.
I hear you. No, almost there's nothing to say except that it seems to be a slightly British preserve currently, looking at other models and having other conversations through Europe, that we seem to be incredibly reluctant. I'm not sure if it's us believing that it's somewhat impeding our freedom or part of the kind of nanny state mentality where we're being watched and kind of monitored. But arguably, when we're talking about substances, which you pointed out are asbestos-like, and at the moment, it's very ad lib as to what to do with them all at the end of life. And otherwise, it seems like the most common sense, objective, practical approach to solving this as an opportunity as much as it is an issue. I think what's really exciting, I know that it's difficult at times to have this conversation because of how potent it is. And frankly, as you said, it is pretty disturbing. But I think that's obviously an important part of the process in terms of making change. If we don't know about something, then we can't make those changes or indeed find solutions or innovations. But I have to say there are some incredibly positive forward-thinking processes and initiatives already underway. We're looking, you and I are talking expressly around the end of life opportunity, which remains one. But we know certainly France in particular is leading on initiatives with newly built boats. For a couple of years now, as you're aware, there have been conversations with governments around if I produce a product or basically any kind of thing that could be a pollutant, I'm therefore responsible for looking after it when it comes to end of life. So this product producer responsibility is still being formulated. Specifically for people who create things like plastic bottles, that once they're end of life, it's my responsibility as a producer to take them back again and do something about it. And the French seem to be taking this on board and putting it into action quite significantly through their initiative, which you'll be able to explain better than I probably can, around new boats, right? If you can afford to buy a new boat, then you are subject to an eco tax effectively, which helps to improve the circularity of that boat coming back to the producer when it's, or at least paying for the disposal of it at end of life. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And it's a tax that you pay per square meter when you buy an absolutely new boat, and that is going to be transferred for the life of the boat, and that tax is going to ultimately collect into a big pot of money that is going to go towards the recycling of that boat in any way, shape or form that might be in, I don't know, 20 years time. That it's a small change that hopefully is going to make a big difference. I know that in the first year when they run this scheme, I think they managed to collect the money for recycling about 4,000 boats out of 100,000. It's a drop in the ocean, but you know, it's a start. Instead, I'm a little bit skeptical that until people realize that there is a threat, a possible threat, you know, life and death or cancer, the steps are not going to be too big, you know.
I can understand that, and I can only thank you wholeheartedly for actually just doing the research, because I think that is always the fundamental linchpin of starting any major conversation, making any major change. Otherwise, it's hearsay and intuition, and even no matter how correct they may be in themselves, having the data and the research as you have done and are doing, provides such a solid foundation for us to have more meaningful conversations across the industry as sailors and different communities and otherwise. So whilst I appreciate that currently it may seem that solutions are limited, we can do a lot of things when we put our minds to it. And like you said, sometimes, unfortunately, it takes a shock. It takes us to realize the impact, the significant impact on our own human health before we make that change. But Karina, I do believe and see by everything that you're doing that this is a fundamental time and a pivotal moment in our industry to start taking this very seriously, also from a legislation perspective.
Thank you. I hope so. As I said, I'm just an ecotoxicologist. I didn't know anything about the boat. And now suddenly, I know a lot about the boat.
I think it's the only way that it could happen, because you're incredibly objective in it. You're looking at it purely from the science perspective. And when you hear an accomplished doctor say that they're just an ecotoxicologist, I mean, my goodness. What a clever, clever brain you are. Really, that's an understatement. Karina, your one final takeaway for the marine industry and also for sailors, what would it be in summary?
We should start with this idea that there should be a stewardship for the material. But because we have this legacy we shouldn't necessarily moan about, but we should actually do something about it. It would be a good idea for the industry and the boat owners to get a little bit more involved with the environment, to think a little bit more about the environment and to have more connection and keep up to date with the latest discoveries and the latest research, and to understand very, very well what's happening under the water. Just because it's not a plastic bag that is floating on the water doesn't mean that the water is actually clean and the sediment is clean. So a little bit more involvement, and the boating industry is quite powerful and it's quite rich as well. So helping with the research would be a really good point, a good brownie point for the industry actually, yeah.
So really connecting science with the industry itself.
Yes.
It's a huge opportunity. If we don't understand something, then we have limited capacity or drive, desire to help protect it.
Yes. I was really touched by the way you started this conversation, by saying that you and a lot of your friends and your community, you think that you're a green community because you say it's so much more than that, is it? It's so much, much more than that. It would be a good point to have a little bit more interaction. And I understand that it's absolutely important for us as scientists to open up a little bit more. Until many years ago, we were just, you know, stuck in our ways. Yes, this is the research. Yes, we publish it on journals that only my colleague in Nottingham and in Sheffield would read or something like that. But now we understand that actually we need to translate our research so that it has enough to show that it has an applicability. And it's important for everyday life, not necessarily for only a scientific journal.
It's a very, very potent point, particularly on issues such as this. Doesn't sit with any one party. And what I was kind of alluding to when you were saying that it's frustrating and a bit disheartening not to know what the solutions are, you almost don't need to find them. You do the research bit, you show what's actually happening and what it really looks like. And it's for all of, you know, a whole plethora of other brilliant yeah. brains in different industries, project managers, innovators, inventors, whatever else, to help bring that about. Because obviously the marine industry, but certainly boat building, is a myriad of roles and skills. So it really has yeah. to be such a collective effort to make such a sustainable, long-lasting and profound change. But Karina, just to say, I'm unsettled in a positive sense and then feeling incredibly motivated by our conversation. The sort of image of these sort of sea snails impaled with our microfiber, fiberglass particles doesn't sit comfortably, and actually nor should it, because it's clear that our industry has a massive opportunity. And as you rightly pointed out, our marine industry is affluent. You know, it's leisure, sailing and boating is a real luxury for most. So we are a demographic largely globally of people who are relatively well educated, who have a degree of disposable income, who appreciate in depth the pleasure that time on the water brings to us. And therefore, we should be certainly naturally placed ambassadors for helping to protect it. And again, really grateful for the research that you're doing and for sharing it and spending this time with me to hopefully bring it to an increasingly wider audience and making an increasingly larger change. Dr. Karina Chokan, Principal Lecturer in Ecotoxicology, Marine Biology at the University of Brighton. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Clean Sailors podcast. All relevant links to the projects and people we talk to can be found with the podcast link. For all episodes or to get in touch, just visit cleansailors.com. We love to hear from you. We believe that great ideas should be shared, which is why our podcast is free to appear on. So if you've got a project, idea, or topic you think we should be discussing, get in touch. In the meantime, thank you for listening and see you for the next episode.